Hey folks, welcome to the Unsung Podcast. I am Mark. There's Chris. That's Chris.
Arigato.
Arigato.
Aye. I don't know any other No, I do know some other Japanese, but it's mostly food.
Oh, do you know the
Konnichiwa.
And you also, I think you're quite familiar with the nuclear bomb warning as well.
Unfortunately, yeah. Have I told that story in the podcast?
I don't know if you've told in the podcast, you've told me.
Yeah, so we're going to talk about a Japanese band this week, but I think Mark's teasing something. But before we get to that little anecdote, Mark, do we have any admin to do?
Yeah, a few bits of admin, a couple of things we should get out of the way right off the bat. First of all, we have a Patreon, so if you're a fan of this podcast and you've been listening to the podcast for a while and you're not on the Patreon, what are you doing? Patreon.com/unsungpod. And if you go there, we've got two options. We've got the basic access all areas, £4 or whatever equivalent currency is per month, and that gives you,
what's that in yen?
I don't know.
50,000
probably yen. 50,000 yen, something like that. And with that you get access to episodes a few days early, you get bonus episodes if and when we do them, and we did do one recently for the first time in a while, and we've got a couple more.
We did two recently. Yeah, we've only put one of them out, but we actually...
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. We've got a couple more than in the barrel coming up as well. And you also get access to our Access All Areas Facebook group, which, yes, I know it's Facebook and it's boomer time, but yeah. It's a really good community and you can actually come and bam us up /...
Yeah, I mean, that's not the primary usage.
It kind of is these days.
Constructive feedback, suggestions for episodes, just general chit-chat. Mm. But also, we do recommend you bam us up. It's a good way to ease tension.
It is.
If you've had a rough day at work, come on that and give us grief.
And then we've got the elevated tier, which is 15 quid a month, or whatever the local equivalent currency is. I hate saying that.
84 million yen.
And with that, we will send you a record from the host of your choice every month, and it'll be records from bands that they're not well known, shall we say.
Yeah, independent. And when Mark's is host of your choice, you can basically, within certain parameters, pick a rough sort of vibe for your music. So if you're not into hip hop, pick me, because I'm terrible at hip hop and I don't really choose any of those albums. If you're into kind of mixture of punk rock and hip hop and stuff, pick Mark. You know, you also get the option of like Dave and Vicky, who've, you know, so you can, and you can vary that month to month to get something different. But we've got loads of stuff in there now, a library of things that are all accrued from across the planet, actually. Mm. Like, have we got any Japanese stuff on it yet?
I think, do we have a Japanese record on it?
We've got a Cambodian one.
Oh.
I don't know if we've got Japanese. We've got Chinese and Cambodian.
Mm.
Oh, I'll have to check.
Yeah.
But yeah, so there's a wide variety of stuff, and because it's Bandcamp, a large percentage of that money goes to them. We keep a bit for the podcast. You're supporting us, you're supporting them, and you get a little surprise every month, which is quite nice.
Mm-hmm. If you are not a part of the podcast, the Patreon group, and you don't really fancy subscribing, which, shame on you, there is some things you can also do to help us, which we'd really appreciate. And it would be just, you know, whatever platform you're using, be it Spotify or Apple. It's Apple Podcast these days. I can't remember. It's been a while since I've used it. But whatever platform you're listening to this podcast on, leave us a rating and review. That'd be brilliant. It really helps get us more exposure, more visibility in front of other people. Mm. And that's kind of what we really want. And if you don't have the ability to do that, then just share an episode with your friends, share it on social media.
Share and tag, please. Aye, that's really helpful because it brings new people into the fold.
That's all we ask of you. If you are not wanting to part with your cash, and that's fair enough, it is hard times at the moment, this is a very simple action you can take.
We shout out to Kaz, a listener that I bumped into last night.
Oh,
Scottish
nice.
Musician, publican, all round good guy. However, I bumped him in the pub, we're having a wee chat, and he's gesturing over to his table, and I won't name names, but sitting at the table was another Scottish musician that I've had a few pops at in this show. And then it turns out Kaz's like, what you been up to? I'm like, oh, I'm making a podcast. He's like, I know, I listen to it. I was like, oh shit. I was like, then you know that. He was like, yeah. I was like, okay. Oh, I'll just stay over here.
I need to know who that person was. You can tell me later.
I'll
on
tell you off here. But hi to Kaz, it was nice to bump into him, and really nice to find out that he's out there lurking in the darkness in the bushes listening, but not sticking his head above the parapets.
Yeah, it's probably a tactical reason for that these days. I don't know.
It seems so, yeah. Anyway, Mark, what's on the agenda this week?
Well, this week the entire country of Japan is on the agenda. No, it's not. Although shout out to my pal Callum, who's probably listening to this from Japan, because he's about to go there for 2 weeks, which is great for him.
We will check when we get our data back. Yeah.
But no, we're going to do the band X Japan.
Yeah. formerly known as X.
As X, yeah. Fascinating story.
Let's be honest, where did this idea come from,
I can't remember.
It was because last week I said to you, do you realise we've done a band from every letter of the alphabet except X?
And it was X. Yeah, X Japan.
But this was on my list anyway of bands that I think needed covered. We also had XTC on there, but without Ferruccio to hand, I wasn't even attempting that. Mm-hmm. But no, X Japan, or X, had to change their name, unsurprisingly, to disambiguate themselves from X, the punk band.
Mm-hmm. Who were also in contention.
Yeah, who were also in contention, that's right. But Japanese metal band, pop metal, I think we could probably...
Pop metal, yeah.
These days, pop metal. What a...
Are they even metal these days?
No, they still are, actually, because the most recent... Well...
Angel was not...
Angel is...
It's definitely not metal.
It's more pop than metal. Yeah. If I could fly from skyscrapers, I'd be flying to you like an angel. And but no, there's some of the stuff that came out alongside their documentary.
Born to Be Free.
We Are X. That's pretty jamming. So, yeah, so this band occurred to me partly because, they're relatively obscure over here. That's the thing. Like, so let's backtrack just a second here and say, what really reeled me in was a quote that I read, which was, Japanese popular music has two eras as defined as pre-X and post-X. And I was like, what? That's big words. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've heard of this band, but what really are they all about? And so in that documentary that I just mentioned there, We Are X, which came out, I think it was 2016, Gene Simmons, no less than Gene Simmons, claims that if X Japan had been, quote, born in America or England and sang in English, they might be the biggest band in the world. Mm-hmm. And coming from a guy like Gene Simmons, who definitely thinks his band are the best band in the world, that's high praise. The Times and the Telegraph over here have written about them in recent years and described them as Japan's unluckiest band, which is an interesting tag.
That is interesting and really debatable, I think.
Yeah, well, interestingly enough, in an interesting fashion about this interesting band, it's a question of perspective. And when he was asked in an interview if the band was unlucky, Yoshiki, we're going to go with that pronunciation, answered, quote, kinda, I mean, you know, with so much crazy drama that has happened over the years, but at the same time, we have amazing fans around the world, so I can't say the world's unluckiest band, but what I can say is the world's luckiest band.
Probably right there.
A very, very successful band. Mm-hmm. I think we're talking about 30 million sales at this point.
Like selling out, like, he sells out the Albert Hall when he plays Siri, sells at Madison Square Garden on a regular basis, you know, whenever he plays. That's just a drummer.
Yeah, they played to 140,000 people across two nights at the Nissan Stadium in Tokyo.
Yeah, so I mean...
Many metal fans and foreign listeners, in the sense of maybe Japanese listeners, East Asian listeners, maybe even Australian, would probably have heard a bit more, will wonder, you know, what are you picking this band for? They just played to 140,000 people over two nights. But the band is very much overlooked here. So I've got a couple of friends in particular who are really big metal heads, especially this kind of metal, you know, kind of fun thrash metal. And they were just like...
Power metal. It's power metal.
It is kind of, it's symphonic, it's power at points. But yeah, and they were like, no, I don't know this band. And that's kind of crazy when you consider their status in other areas. So they don't have the same cultural significance here as they do for folks from the East or for diehard metal enthusiasts a lot of them. Yeah, they're a really fascinating group, really fascinating proposition, and there's so much to get into. So buckle up, because we're going to go through a little bit about their history, where they came from, the timeline around the band, because they've been about since 1977, albeit they were 11 years old when they formed the band. We'll go into that. We'll go into some of the little kind of tangents. Anybody that's noticed that they're called X Japan may wonder if Elon Musk's going to make an appearance, and he does. We'll also talk a bit about the individual members, because, wow, some of those stories are astonishing. And we'll talk a little bit about discography, as we always do. And then we're going to focus on a particular album called Vanishing Vision. This is their debut album, which was actually released on their own record label. And it was kind of hard, because in the build-up to this, really we just wanted to talk about the phenomenon in this band. So we're trying to decide what album to come at it from.
Or if we even should, an album.
Or do we just do it like a documentary? But no, I think Vanishing Vision deserves a mention, because effectively it's a DIY album. Mm-hmm. of incredible success. But it's a really bold move, and I think they deserve a lot of respect for it. I don't actually think it's the best album. I think the best album is probably Blue Blood, the one that comes after it, which was a major label debut with Sony. But we'll talk about Vanishing Vision, because wow, just what these guys achieved straight out the gates off their own backs was pretty stunning.
So what are we going to do in this episode?
Yeah, in this episode, I think we'll start by just taking a little journey through a bit of the lore, a bit of their timeline, and have a look at some of the early years. So by all accounts, back in the day, Japan was quite a conservative musical culture, quite a conservative creative culture. And X are kind of credited as blowing that open a bit. I think 2011, Consequence of Sound had named them one of their top 15 cult acts. By the way, an amusing turn of phrase that will become relevant later on.
Yeah.
But there's a writer called Brian Burton Lewis, and he said, in Japan, the image that we have of an X audience is rural kids going through a rebellion phase, but they put their life into being X fans. They dress like it. They breathe it. X initially became known partly for their look, because their look is stunning. And they helped kick off what's known now as the Visual Kei movement in Japan, KEI. But yeah, Asia Week, for example, described them as having an angry sound that rejected the cookie cutter principles of Japanese society. And their fans are so enthusiastic. I mean, Japan has its fair share of cultish behaviour, especially around about pop stars. In fact, East Asia does as well, because in South Korea, I mean, the K-pop bands are famous for their armies of fans now who go to extreme lengths. And sometimes actually that comes with a really dark downside, which we'll also mention as we're going through the fates of some of the different members. But this band really represented a watershed in Japanese culture and Japanese youth culture, throwing off some of that kind of post-war conservatism and general depression. You know, because you've got this entire cultural phenomenon of the otaku and this group of like shamed children, the sons and daughters of Japanese war veterans seen as having let their country down and all that. It was a really complex time, and the 70s was like, you know, there's a big tumult culturally going on, and from that came a punk movement, and then came bands like this. They also really took, the youth at that time took to a lot of the movements that were going on in the States and over here. So bands like The Cure and bands in the States like Motley Crue and stuff like that, they were really, really looked up to. And X, or X Japan in this case, appropriated a lot of elements of that, but became, I mean, they actually, I'd say if anything, amplified it. They took it to an even greater heights. They were formed in 1982 in Chiba as X. Chiba's about 40 kilometres east of Tokyo centre. I mean, if you know Tokyo, you know that Tokyo is a super city. It's a megalopolis or whatever you call it. And it's 33 million people. It's enormous and has absorbed not just little villages and towns, but other cities. So Chiba's 40 kilometres east of Tokyo's sort of centre proper. The original members were the kind of drummer and keys player Yoshiki, who get a lot of mentions, and the vocalist Toshi. Despite numerous members over the years, those two founders still actually play in the band. They've had 5 studio albums, 6 live albums, 21 singles. Gamers might know them from Rock Band 2. I think they had a track in that as well. Loudwire titled them Japan's best metal act. As I said, estimated, I think, about 30 million, probably more, sales now. They started their own Ecstasy Records, so they've got that kind of the roots in DIY that we'll come back to. I mentioned they were known at one point for their visual aesthetic. They dropped that by about 1996 with the release of an album called Dahlia, and then they actually broke up the year after in very interesting circumstances that we'll get to. But funnily enough, did you notice that despite their huge reputation in Japan, their first overseas show wasn't until after their reunion in 2007 in Hong Kong, and then they did a US tour in 2010. But until that point, they had never played gigs abroad. They travelled abroad to record. They travelled to the States to record.
Yeah, they're on studio in Los Angeles.
Yeah, but they'd never toured or played, which is wild.
So see, when they had that hiatus, maybe you don't know this, but did Yoshiki do solo shows outside of Japan? Because he did a lot of work.
He worked and lived in LA, so I would imagine he did.
And he did a lot of work with like various orchestras and other artists as well. Like,
that's right, aye. So. But the band X, or X Japan, never actually did. So to roll it right back, there's going to be a lot of names kicking about in here. I wanted to get the full names, because you actually don't see the full names used very often. So I went onto a fan forum, and wow, this is an illustration of what we're going to encounter as this goes on. It had their full names It also had the blood types of every band member. So here you go. You've got Toshi, and please excuse my pronunciation, I'll do my best here, which is Toshimitsu Diyama. He's A. You got Hide, who's Hidetu Matsumoto, is AB. You got Pata, his real name is Tomoaki Ishizuka, is B. You got Heath, his real name's Hiroshi Mori, B. It's good that either of them gets injured. They can rely on each other. You've got Taiji Sawada, who's A again. And of course, you've got Yoshiki, who's also B, Yoshiki Hayashi. So plenty of B's there in case anyone gets unwell. And boy, do they get unwell. Yoshiki's...
Also, there's also a guy that plays for them just now called, I don't know his full name, but Sugizo.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I couldn't find his full name either. He's been drafted in on guitar.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He dabbled in like periodic guitar stuff and then they brought him in full time. We'll explain why as we go. But Yoshiki's the main figure here. We'll talk about him in depth later on when we start going through the band members because there's a lot there.
He's pretty much the engine of the band.
Aye. He's the main writer by far as well. So Yoshiki and his friend Toshi formed a band called Dynamite in 1977 when they were only 11 years old. They went to school together. They changed the name of Dynamite to Noise in 1978 and then they disbanded Noise in 1982 and formed X. So technically, they were in that band Noise for 5 years, 4 years, 5 years if you take in Dynamite. They were originally named X temporarily while they were waiting on a proper name, but then ended up keeping it. They began gigging in Tokyo properly in about 1985. So quite a bit of time had passed.
It's a long time to not gig.
But they were really young, you know, 11 years old. So by the time 7 years had passed, they were only just of legal age to go out gigging anyway. Mm. They originally tried to be part of the punk movement, but didn't really fit. I think the quote I read was they were too commercial and flamboyant. Yoshiki said, when we started the band, the problem was we didn't belong anywhere because we were playing very heavy music, we were wearing tons of makeup and crazy outfits, so we couldn't belong anywhere. The basic timeline of events in the band from that point on, their first ever single was I'll Kill You in 1985. They also that year added a tune called Break the Darkness to a successful compilation called Heavy Metal Force 3. Mm-hmm. Fucking brilliant name for a compilation, isn't it? And in April 1986, Yoshiki formed Ecstasy Records, that's E-X-T-A-S-Y. So they had an outlet for their own music. They released their second single, Orgasm. And then contributed two more songs, Stab Me in the Back and No Connection, connection with an X, to another popular sampler of the time. So they were starting to crop up alongside some of the better known Japanese metal bands of that period, including one called Saber Tiger, who would go on to give them a member. Around this time, the first proper recognised lineup of the band kind of coalesced, with Taiji joining permanently on bass guitar, the part-time guitarist Pata joining permanently, and then quite a famous and popular member called Hide, who was in Saber Tiger, joining on guitar. And that quintet became the grouping in what became some of their famous early photos, with a really wild hair. Really wild hair. I mean, so you're talking like well past shoulder length, bleached blonde hair, with one side down and curly and the other side in these like nearly 2 foot high spikes and things like that. Like just really flamboyant. In 1987, they played a huge event called Rock Monster in Tokyo, and then took part in, it was some kind of like band audition thing. I don't know if it was like a, almost closer to a Battle of the Bands thing for Sony, but that actually ultimately earned them a deal the following year. But in the meantime, they recorded and released a debut album, the one we're going to talk about in a bit more detail in the next part, Vanishing Vision. That came out on April the 14th, 1988, via their own label, Ecstasy Records. It had an initial pressing of 10,000 copies. It sold out in a week. A DIY release of 10,000 copies sold out in a week. Just pause a moment to consider the music scene today. 10,000 copies is way more than it takes to get to number one in the UK charts now.
Do you think they hand did all the sleeves and stuff themselves?
Don't get that impression. No. But yeah, so that
it's
actually...
not properly DIY then.
That's true. That's true. Sellouts. But that actually was enough to get into number 19 on the main charts.
Yeah.
I mean, first of all, the fact that 10,000 only got them onto number 19 shows you how many people were buying records, even just in Japan. But it's a staggering achievement for a young band. It really is. They were the first independent act to ever do so in the Japanese chart history. So they then went on and performed a couple of tours in Japan, selling out these huge venues. In March, I think, in 1989, they sold out all the advance tickets for the tour of their album. In April that year, they released Blue Blood, which was their first release on a major label. It was on Sony. That was almost exactly 1 year after that debut, and it debuted at number six in the charts. They then went on the Rose and Blood tour, but that was suspended. Well, you know, the tour came to an untimely early end due to Yoshiki collapsing on stage. This happens a number of times. We'll talk about that a bit more when we discuss the members as well. In 1990, they flew to LA, we were talking about this, to record their next record. And when they flew back to Japan, they needed 500 members of the military to help control the crowd at the airport.
That's fucking crazy, man. That's Elvis level shit.
It's like, mad, isn't it? Uh-huh. So Jealousy, the album they'd recorded in the States, was released July 1991 and it debuted at number one in the Japanese charts.
It's probably important to mention at this point that when they started going to America and stuff, they started to really want to break into international markets. From that, from this point in their career, some of the songs on the first two records are sung in English, but it starts to become a much more prominent feature, almost to the point where Toshi actually begins to get singing lessons and vocal lessons in English in order to improve. Mm-hmm. He already has a pretty good voice anyway.
Yeah, apparently he could speak English well, but it was about pronunciation. Yeah. And being convincing.
He ended up working with a guy. I can't remember his name, but it'll probably come up later on when we talk more about him. But I ended up working with a guy who was a vocal coach for like Gwen Stefani and stuff like that.
Oh, really?
In 1993, yeah.
Interesting. So around about that time, they did a Tokyo Dome show. Now that's 55,000 people as part of the Violence and Jealousy tour. Again, though, that tour ended early with Yoshiki collapsing on stage. I've actually been to the Tokyo Dome.
Yeah, I remember.
Yep, and this ties back to my experience of being fluent in Japanese emergency sounds. Mm. I went to see Wrestle Kingdom in 2018.
Did Kenny Omega do his promo in Japanese or English?
You know what? I can't remember. I think he did it in both.
Yeah.
And he's fluent in both.
Yeah,
and there were multiple versions of it. And what's his name was there as well?
Okada.
Chris Okada, but Chris Jericho was there.
Oh, okay.
And Cody Rhodes was there as well.
Ah, yeah, that would have been during that period in time. Was a very good period in time for indie wrestling.
There was a lot of crossover as well, some big names in it. Yeah, so it was a really fantastic experience, apart from the first night I spent in Tokyo getting woken up rolling from side to side in the bed because the high rise hotel I was in was caught in an earthquake, and I was literally bouncing about in that fucking room, and it was terrifying. I mean, is it racist to impersonate the emergency announcement? Because the emergency announcement was very, very funny. The way this wee guy was very slowly articulating in a comedic fashion, attention, attention, the building will not fall down.
Brilliant.
And then the next morning, somewhat fucking traumatised and definitely still quite tired from the night before, went to a cafe on the corner and everybody's phones started flashing yellow and fucking all these alarms started going off. I'd never seen a phone do that in my life. And it was because fucking Kim Jong-un was firing missiles across the Northern Ireland of Japan and they were doing like a test warning for a nuclear attack. It was a fucking adventure. It was actually one of the greatest weeks of my life. It was fantastic, but it started off 100 miles an hour.
I'm going to go back to the wrestling for a second. was that Omega Okada you saw?
Yeah.
That would have been fucking insane, man.
It was brilliant, except I was falling asleep.
That sucks.
Like, no joke. The event was about 8 hours long.
Aye.
I got there at like midday and was sat in that arena all day. And by the end of it, I was doing that thing that I used to do when I was at high school and try to stay awake of like holding my eyes open because I was absolutely losing it.
Burst.
Like my chin was just flopping down. You know, like you watch kittens try to stay awake. That was me. One more thing. Wrestling question.
Yeah, the crowd in the Tokyo Dome are very well known for being quiet.
Aye.
Is that?
Oh, they're really well behaved.
Yeah,
they applaud.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like watching Crufts or something like that. Uh-huh. Everybody waits until something's been done and then they clap. They're really enthusiastic, but just incredibly well behaved. And then you had like effectively four Scottish people at the back just disgracing themselves. So started 1992 with 3 days sold out at the Tokyo Dome. Again, 55,000 capacity.
150,000 people.
165,000 people sold out 3 days in a row. So this is, you're now talking about a really fucking big band that we are still absolutely clueless about in the West at this stage. That same month, Taiji left the group. Now, the band cited musical differences. Taiji, in his biography or autobiography, says he was forced out after confronting Yoshiki over the large difference in income between him and the other members. We'll talk about why that is in a wee bit.
What did Yoshiki say, that he broke a rule?
He broke a rule.
And it's unclear what that rule is.
Yeah, I mean, I saw speculation about other things, but frankly, I didn't really see much basis for that. It seemed like Taiji just wasn't happy with the disparity in income and raised it. He's like, does it have to be quite this extreme? And that just caused an atmosphere that, you know,
a literal fight in a bar between them.
Yeah, like a fist fight in a bar that then descended into them sobbing. Imagine fucking seeing that with those haircuts. Imagine seeing those guys with those haircuts trying to punch each other and then breaking down greeting with their big leather shoulder pads and what a pantomime.
The thing as well is that people will have known who they are as well. Just, you know what I mean? So it'll be totally strange.
Tell you, they're really lucky that mobile phones weren't a common thing. Yeah, so imagine totally, that going viral. So later that year, Heath was announced as a new bassist replacing Taiji. Around about then as well, Toshi, the vocalist, began his solo work in the background, which would eventually get to about 30 plus albums. Now, there's a very big asterisk next to this, which again we'll unpack when we're talking about the various fates of the various members. According to his own website, his Utatabi travelling concert tour included over 3,000 concerts between 1999 and 2003. So I just did some like back of a bag packet maths.
It's like three shows a day.
It's like, yeah, so you did more than two shows every single day for 4 years.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, I'm sceptical about that.
I'm not giving well, okay, the company that he kept it. I'm not.
Yeah, maybe once folk hear exactly what was going on, they might believe that, because maybe it was a bit of slave labour going on there, but I think it may be an exaggeration. Yeah, that seems the likeliest. So yeah, their success though as a band collectively led to them accepting an international contract from Atlantic Records in 1992.
Was that not a hard fought as well? Like, I think there was a, I could be making this up, so I might be completely wrong, but I think, did they not get into a disagreement with Sony because they wanted Sony to release it internationally as well, and they wouldn't do it?
Well, so they stayed on Sony in Japan, I believe, and Atlantic took the rest of the world. At that point as well, they were also forced to now change the name because they were still X, but it became X Japan because of, you know, the need to disambiguate it from X the punk band. However, they never actually went on and released an American album or indeed an international album. The album Art of Life came out in 1993 and was just one track of 29 minutes. Fly, but I wanna dress my life on the Now, it debuted at number one in Japan, but the band only did two concerts that year. Those two concerts took place on December the 30th and the 31st, and that actually went on to become a better tradition. They'd been doing a lot of stuff during the year with their solo careers, so that was their only two ex-Japan performances. They only did four shows the year after, 1994, for the same reasons. It's worth noting as well, but I don't know if you spotted this, that around about that period when they were all working on their various individual projects, Hide's first solo album came out, and it was called Hide Your Face. Or Hide Your Face. Yeah. And it did make me think, like, that's like if Weaver brought out an album and it was called David Your Face.
Yeah.
But yeah, clearly spotting the pun there and grabbing it with both hands.
I mean, it's a bit of a shame that they did the international signing with that particular period of musical history, given their sound, because grunge was happening and everybody was over what they sounded like.
That's true, but also releasing a one track 29 minute album sung in broken English is not going to massively appeal to Atlantic Records, really. Early 1995 was also quiet until around about November, when they began touring for the upcoming Dahlia material. This was the new stuff they'd been working on, but again the tour was cut short due to Yoshiki's health. This time he had a herniated disc in his back. In September 22, 1997, they actually announced that the band was disbanding. Obviously, the Dahlia record's out at that point, but Toshi was a big part of that. He claimed his decision was due to feeling unfulfilled by a glamorous celebrity lifestyle. But this was later revealed to be what we'll call cult issues.
Yes, cult issues. Aye.
The band played their last show, up to that point anyway, called Broken English here, The Last Live, colon, Last Night. At the Tokyo Dome on December 31st, 1997. That'll also get a mention when we're going through Toshi's story. In 2000, Pata and Heath teamed up with INA from the band Spread Beaver. Yes, the band Spread Beaver. And if you've ever followed Japanese music, you actually probably know Spread Beaver, because they're not insignificant in the pantheon of Japanese bands. But that project that they did with him became Dope Heads. Again, I mean, it's such a fucking 2000s name. So Dope, and then Heads is capital H-E-A-D, then a little Z, Dope Heads. I mean, it sounds like it would be nu metal. It's not actually. It's kind of like a punkier version of Helicopters, in a Swedish band, mixed with like a couple of nu metal touches. It's actually not that bad. I was expecting something, some abomination, but no, it's decent.
I mean, they're all good musicians that know the way around a song, even if the songwriting isn't for you. They know how to write fucking songs, man. So.
Yep. Hide had a band called Zilch with Joey Castillo of Queens of Stone Age,
really?
As well as Paul Raven of Killing Joke. Yeah,
I wonder how they found him.
I don't know. I mean, people who are in music, certainly big bands that are touring in the Far East, would become aware.
Yeah, because they're a big band as well. So
spoiler alert here, though. The Zilch album, which was called 3-2-1, came out posthumously for Hide. So there you go. Came out in 1998. 2 months after he died. You will hear all about that shortly. Yoshiki had also collaborated with Roger Taylor, a Queen, on a track at one point.
Can't fuck with that. Yep. I've just made a second Nexus in my head.
Yeah. There's fucking plenty of them. In 2006, Toshi travelled to LA to work with Yoshiki on a tribute track for Hide. They announced publicly the resumption of working together, and then obviously loads of speculation began. When the single, which was called Without You, came out, they announced that they were in talks with Pata and Heath to potentially reform ex-Japan, and they then made their first public appearance in 2007 when they were recording a video for a new track called IV. That track actually became the main theme for the film Saw 4, as in Saw IV in Roman numerals. IV is also quite relevant to Yoshiki though, based on his childhood and his health. And that track actually utilised guitar recordings that had been done by Hide prior to his death.
That's cool.
For earlier material. And the band made a full comeback with three concerts again at the Tokyo Dome in March of 2008. Each show featured guest guitarists standing in for Hide. Those guitarists were Sugizo of the Japanese band Luna Sea, who you mentioned, who would eventually turn into a permanent member. Also included Richard Fortus, who was the guitarist for Guns N' Roses.
Still is, still is.
Yep. And Wes Borland.
I mean, I buy that, man, because like Limp Bizkit played Japan a lot.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely. And Borland clearly really liked him as well, because he did stuff for them later on too. The show featured the hologram of Hide performing the track Art of Life, but it does seem that there were a lot of technical issues around that hologram, especially in the opening night, and it delayed the concert by 2 hours. And then that concert ended after 8 songs when, as you can probably guess, Yoshiki collapsed on stage again.
Was there a riot?
You would think there might be, wouldn't you? In June of 2008, all of their scheduled shows were postponed due to Yoshiki's back injury returning. In 2009, as we said, Sugizo became permanent member, but the band apparently considered them the sixth member, since in their opinion, Hide, the deceased Hide, was still the fifth member. In 2010, the band announced relocation to Los Angeles and plans for a sixth album. More on that album to follow.
Yeah, I mean, that album's never happened.
In August 2010, they did 2 shows at Nissan Stadium. Mentioned these earlier. It's the biggest venue in Japan. Now, the Tokyo Dome is the biggest indoor venue in Japan. The Nissan Stadium is even bigger, 70,000 capacity, albeit it's outdoor. So 2 nights sold out at that, 140,000 spectators. And then there's a big mulch of like half releases, plans, shows in North America, loads of media shite.
Singles.
From then on up to date, right? But let's mention what I would like to christen Japanese democracy.
By the way, can I just say,
well, wait a minute, don't fucking ruin my drop. Sorry, there.
That was good, yeah. You've got to mention they played the Lollapalooza in 2010.
They did.
Yeah, which is, I think, is worth mentioning as well.
The year of their first American shows, yeah. Yeah, as I mentioned, in 2015 they announced that the sixth album would be released on the very specific date of March the 11th, 2016. Needless to say, that came and went. The We Are X documentary was also due to be premiered in London on March the 12th, and the band had announced a show for Wembley Stadium. I think they were trying to join everything up at that point, but as the album was just nowhere even close to coming out. And in January 2016, Pata was rushed to hospital with a life-threatening condition, and soon after, the Wembley show was postponed for a full year. It did eventually happen though. It happened on March the 4th in 2017.
Was that a sellout?
Don't know, actually. Yeah, not sure. I think it was very successful. Don't know if it was a sellout, but there were a lot of like very famous faces at it as well. In April 2017, Yoshiki said all the album tracks for number 6 were recorded and they were at the mixing stage, meaning the album would be out in, quote, the next few months. And that October, the album was then announced for spring 2018. At Coachella 2018, Marilyn Manson joined Yoshiki on stage to play Sweet Dreams.
Jesus Christ.
Yep. And then interviewed soon after, Yoshiki announced that the album was now coming out in the fall of 2018. In February of 2019, he said that the album was finished, but he was, quote, waiting on the perfect time to release it. And given that the record at one point was apparently due to feature Marilyn Manson, it would be really interesting to see when the perfect time was to release it. Might not be anytime soon. They did eventually release a single track called Angel in July 2023, which is turbo shite. Awful, soppy, fucking soft metal.
I actually think that's part of the reason why that record will never be released. I don't think the band will ever release a record ever again.
Unless it becomes like Smile, you know, Brian Wilson's Smile. And Heath would die of colon cancer in late October 2023. And since then, there's not really been a lot of development in the story of ex-Japan themselves. I did drop Elon Musk's name into proceedings earlier on. This is just a tiny little tangent here, but Twitter Japan, we aside. So Elon Musk bought Twitter, obviously, and rebranded it as X. Twitter in Japan was known as Twitter Japan. It was a slightly different entity. And so Musk, clearly just being Elon Musk, announced it was becoming X Japan. Mm-hmm. And then Yoshke, funnily enough, replied on Twitter that that name's already taken. So eventually Musk had to concede and he declared they would call it X Nippon. Mm-hmm. Now, Nippon's apparently the formal pronunciation of Japan in the native tongue. Mm-hmm. So there you go,
that's
they won.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, we talked as well about a bit of the tension in the band, like, for example, the disparity in income and stuff. It kind of comes down to musical credits, the songwriting credits, because Yoshke has the vast majority. Hide penned a few tracks, including one single called Scars. Toshi only, despite being the vocalist and really the front person, only ever really gets credit for selected lyrics, not even the bulk of lyrics. And both Heath and Pata had very little songwriting involvement. You know, they did a couple of isolated tracks as a bit of a Ringo vibe to their writing. I know there's other theories about why people were kicked out and what the rules were that were broken, but honestly, I think, like, you know, Occam's razor, I think it was tension over the gulf in income that came from the music. And I'm sure Yoshke thinks it's perfectly justified, being that he is hugely in charge of the songwriting and the sound of the band.
I always find that conversation very interesting, because performers will often have a little bit more input into the songwriting process than I think they can often get credited for. I'm not saying, or I don't even know, that they all had huge amounts of input, but I'm pretty sure, like, Hide had a large say on how the guitar solos were written, you know, which is a fundamental feature of a lot of their faster, heavier songs. Mm-hmm. So I think there's probably something in that, you know.
But tracks, royalties get broken down in different ways, they don't they? So you'll have performance royalties, you'll have music royalties, and you'll have lyrical royalties. And from the sounds of it, Yoshke had the majority of lyrical royalties. He had the majority of musical royalties because he was a multi-instrumentalist. Mm-hmm. And so even though he mainly played drums live and a bit of piano and keys and stuff, he was also, like, all over the other instruments for this, including the orchestration. So that's a lot of percentages getting tallied
Definitely,
up there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then on top of that, he's then got a split of the performance credits as well. So, and, you know, and then all your kind of royalties from the tracks live, it really tallies up. You can only speculate as to what the division was, but I would imagine it was multiples of the other members probably combined.
Yeah, you're probably right. And he's a virtuoso when it comes to the piano. Mm-hmm. I mean, his drumming is whatever, right? Really?
I actually think he's quite a good drummer.
He's a good drummer, but it's not a feature of the band that makes me go, wow, do you know what I mean?
I mean, they're not. It's not Neil Peart. You know what I mean? I've actually seen them compared to Dream Theater in certain places as well.
I think some of the later stuff has got elements of Dream Theater to it, but it's still too 80s.
Yeah, but to be honest, I kind of prefer that. It rattles along a lot more. It's a lot more direct. You're right, it's not as flashy as other drummers, but fucking, he scuds it. Mm. Like, there's some total belters, and they're BPM wise, certainly the first two albums are really fast.
Very fast. That explains his neck brace.
Yeah. You know, he actually had to get a fake vertebrae put in.
Yeah, he's had two back surgeries. I did read that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So his vertebrae was so fucked, they just removed it and gave him a falsie.
I mean, it's got to be ill health, though. That can't, like, there's drummers that play way faster than him for, like, much longer and much bigger tours. It's got to be health related, that.
He talks about when he was wee, how he was so skinny and frail, really struggled with his health. I mean, he was a really small kid as well. He's a normal looking Japanese guy now, you know, not the tallest guy you'll ever meet, but certainly, you know, proportionately normal for a Japanese man. But I think as a youngster, he was really, people really worried about him. Mm-hmm. He spent a lot of time in hospital. We'll talk about that in a wee bit. Let's go back and just touch on Visual Key, because I think that's a really...
Must we?
I think it's a really interesting subject. Again, I just want to say, we've seen Visual Key. I believe that's how it's pronounced. It's K-E-I. Mm. It could be K, could be Key.
I've heard it pronounced as Visual Key.
So. Yeah. So Koji Dejima of Bounce wrote that Visual Key is not a specific sound, but rather it, quote, revolves around the creation of a band's unique worldview and or stylistic beauty through visual expressions in the form of makeup and fashion. It basically means getting fucking dressed up like mental.
It's glam, it's fashion on steroids.
It's somewhere between Motley Crue and Gwar. It's absolutely fucking wild. So X did not start Visual Key, which was an emerging movement. Basically, as the UK and American influences crossed the sea, I'm sure we'll name a few shortly. The name, though, is thought to originate from the band's slightly odd early slogan of, quote, psychedelic violence, crime of visual shock, which is written on the cover of the Blue Blood album. If you look at the blue
in the
X,
middle of the X
on it.
Mm.
Yeah. It's kind of straight. Psychedelic violence, crime of visual shock. So the
kind of makes sense when you look at them in that era. They are psychedelic and it is visually shocking.
Yeah, crime. Yeah. So, the derivation is credited as being coined by Saichi Hoshiko, the founding editor of Shox magazine, S-H-O-X-X magazine, which was founded in 1990 as the first publication devoted to the subject of visual kei. And they've said that, quote, even though X-Japan was a big band and people used the term okeshu kei to describe them, or okeshu kei, the term is still lacking substance. I didn't like the term at all. Because of this, I tried to remind all the writers not to use this term, as they are not okeshu kei, they are visual shock kei, based on, you know, the slogan that was on that cover. And from there, it went from visual shock kei to visual kei to actually a lot of people just call it V-kei as well. That's like a big thing, but they abbreviate it right down. So X based their image initially on a mixture of Kiss, Hello, Boy. Yoshiki actually met Boy at the show at Wembley.
Oh, London. That's cool.
Yeah, there's photos of them sitting together. Then just general kind of glam rock, and also, importantly, Kabuki theatre.
Makes sense.
Kabuki's famed for those really elaborate dress-ups and dance, as well as the, I think it's called Kumadori makeup. You'll know it if you see it. You know, it's like a grimace and black and white face. Mm-hmm. You see a lot of masks done up like that as well. Kabuki makeup actually definitely suggests an influence on Kiss and Arthur Brown and also black metal. When they were coming up with their face paint designs, they were taking some cues from some of the Kabuki masks. Other influential acts from a glam metal perspective included Twisted Sister, we mentioned Motley Crue, Hanoi Rocks as well.
You can totally see Hanoi Rocks.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And not all of the early adopters were actually metal. There was a lot of punk and post-punk playing a part in the gothier aspect. So you had The Cure and Suzy Sue, the really Buffon hairdos, you know, the really messed up kind of squirrely thing that they did as well. Like I said, there's video of Yoshiki walking about with like half his hair done, like almost like Robert Smith, and the rest of it is in these enormous blonde spikes. It's like right down the middle. It's really unusual. And there are plenty of other bands that are famed for that vibe. A couple of names, Buck Tick. And a band called Dead End. Being totally honest, it's highly unlikely that those names are going to mean much to our listeners, so there's no point in us going through lots of them. Dead End, you might know if you're into Metal Blade Records. We gave them a mention recently on a bonus episode. Metal Blade put out two records by Dead End. In terms of the ex-Japan outfits, there are comparisons between Toshi and characters from Gundam anime.
I was going to say there's an anime feel to that. I don't watch, in fact, I'm very not all favourite anime, but when I saw them, the first thing that popped into my mind was like, that looks like something right out of anime.
So he was really into squaring off the shoulders with these big bulky sort of like bolt-on things, and he had like metal bits in his costumes, and that kind of nodded to a lot of that Gundam stuff. Taiji went for like pretty boy vibes in his. Pata had a trademark whiskey bottle as part of his costume, you know, it was part of their sort of famous drunks. Were there an American metal at the time, like Lemmy.
Yeah.
Lemmy and stuff like that. I'm saying American metal, British metal. The Times describe X-Japan as having, quote, the grandiosity of Queen, the heavy metal hysteria of Iron Maiden, and the symphonic sophistication of classical music, all tied up with a healthy dose of melodrama. The first visual kei act to perform internationally was actually Lunacy in 1989. because as we mentioned, ex-Japan didn't get out of Japan until 2007 after they reformed. But as of like 2002, it actually stepped up thanks to a lot of Japanese themed conventions, because there was a lot of manga and anime catching on, Comic-Con stuff. And
yeah, the internet's really helped to explode that as well.
Since, oh, it has, you know. Hugely. Also, the inclusion of a visual kei band called Deren Grey on Korn's...
I've heard them. I think they were definitely on an American record label.
They were on Family Values Tour with Korn, 2006. Okay. And that really popularised that group in the West and helped spread the word about the movement. From 2001, a second wave of visual kei started to emerge over in Japan. They actually called it Neo Visual Kei, and that includes bands like The Gazette and Alice Nine. In 2007, visual kei was revitalised when Yoshiki, Gackt, Sugizo and Miyavi formed a short-lived supergroup called Skin, S-K-I-N. And there's now a reaction with visual kei seen as being a bit passé. You know, we're at a point now where being non-conformist is actually quite conformist in a lot of minds. As far back as about 1998, Neil Strauss reported that to visual kei bands, After X makeup and outrageous looks became more important than the music.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably something similar to a lot of glam bands with that as well.
Mm-hmm. It became like tick a box, get signed, get associated with this. And that criticism really persists to this day, with there being an awful lot of style over content in the genre. In fact, Deren Grey, the band that I mentioned who were on the Family Values Tour, the bassist Toshiya has said in 2010 in an interview, quote, "To be honest, when we first started and we were wearing a lot of makeup on stage and stuff, there were a lot of bands doing that at the time in Japan and people thought it was cool, but it's not anymore. The music was so unique too. Bands like ex-Japan, at that time, there weren't any two bands that sounded alike. These days, everyone sounds exactly the same."
Mm-hmm.
It's also noted here as well, and I think this is just a nice way for us to maybe to conclude side A, Mark, that the genre attracts an overwhelmingly female fan base. It includes a lot of nods to homoeroticism within the performances as well. And nodding to wrestling again, there are parallels with the fan service aspect. That's something that's big in manga, but I think it's also something that's big in wrestling. You know, there's a lot of sort of tropes that you're expected to complete, a lot of things that are just part of a performance in order for a performance to tick all the boxes. That
it goes back to vaudeville and wrestling, doesn't it? It's like, you still, at the end of the day, wrestlers are still really just carnies. Fundamentally, that's what they are.
Yeah, up to the ropes. You know, appeal to the fans. Top rope, wave your hand when something shocks you, look around the room, all these different little things, you know, that you tick off. So actually, their performances started to have a lot of that crossover from manga, from wrestling. And when you see the extremes they go to, with their, not just with their costumes, but with their set dressings and stuff like that as well, it's a huge spectacle.
It seems as though I've seen some of the clips of them live, even more recently, and it still has got that massive spectacle aspect of it, you know. I think even though they don't have that look anymore, they all look fairly normal in terms of how rock stars look, you know. They don't look like you or I, but the show still have that huge level of, like, just drama, because they're a dramatic band.
Yeah.
And in every single way.
Well, that's the thing, that there's so much performative drama around the band. God knows they don't need the real drama.
Yeah, but they have so much.
They
of
have
that
a lot of real drama. So to give you an idea of what's coming up side B of this, we'll go through the members of the band, a number of whom are no longer with us in all manner of different interesting ways. And we'll also talk a bit about the various fortunes of the members that are still with us. I mean, the band's still effectively playing, or not playing, but there's still an entity, there's still a functional going concern, albeit they've had to bring in new people and make alterations. But yeah, the story gets very, very bumpy. There's some just incredible twists to it. Then we'll go through a bit of their back catalogue. It's only 5 studio albums, given that, you know, Japanese democracy still hasn't and probably never will actually appear. And then we'll focus a bit on a Vanishing Vision before concluding with our Nexus.
Great, yeah. So thanks for listening to this episode. As we said back at the start, give us a share, give us a rating and review on your Spotify, your Apple Podcasts, whatever platform you use, because it's really helpful, because we want more people to hear this podcast. And the only way that happens is if you do something like that, if you take the action and share it. So please do that.
Yep. Tags. We always say, if there's an episode you particularly like, just even sharing it on your wall, or, you know, sharing it in your feed, your story, your reel, whatever format you're using, it's great.
Yeah.
Right, we'll see you on side B. Is it Konnichiwa?
I believe so.
Let's hope so.